The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So I'm going to talk this morning about taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is how it's referred to and how we refer to it. So I was kind of inspired to talk about this today because I was able to practice yesterday a little bit with a couple of the local bhikkhunis in the Bay Area. Well, their vihara now is in Placerville, Ayasantachitta and Ayanandabodhi. And I was just taking a lot of joy and feeling a lot of safety and taking refuge with the monastic sangha. And it got me thinking about how taking refuge has been so supportive of my practice for many years. So I wanted to just kind of share these thoughts with you. And kind of, I don't know how many people might turn to taking refuge in some way as an actual practice. You know, it's something that people do and recite a lot in various parts of Asia. It happens to be... I happened to just adopt a personal practice of taking refuge every time I started to sit in the morning since 2006. And I actually got that practice from, I practiced in a different tradition for about 6 months with the Tri Ratna tradition. And they do the chanting quite frequently, the more of the typical, even though they're not a strictly Theravada tradition, they take the refuges and precepts together a lot in their sittings. And I just adopted it as doing it to myself silently before I would sit in the morning, taking the refuges, taking the precepts. And just noticing over the years how this has evolved and really supported my practice. To the point now when I sit down and I take the refuges for myself, there's really an energetic thing that happens and a focusing and a centering on the practice and a sort of a recommitment and a sense of intention that builds. So I just want to share some of these thoughts with you about taking refuge. And just maybe contemplate it as something they might incorporate into your own practice in some way. So what are we taking refuge from, you know, when we take refuge? Well, for me, it's taking refuge from the conditioned patterns of the mind that are causing me stress and suffering. And I often actually, when I'm starting to take refuge, I contemplate and think about what's the conditioning that's coming up for me, recently, that I need to turn back to the practice as a source of refuge rather than anything else. Sometimes I love this because the texts often talk about these habits of mind or these delusion or these hindrances or defilements that come up in our mind, greed, hatred, and delusion, and the specific hindrances you may all have heard of as Mara, as he's sort of embodies the tempter or the trickster that tricks us out of happiness and joy and tricks us away from knowing the truth into instead relating to our experience in a way that causes suffering. So that's in a way what we're taking refuge from is this condition, this state predicament that we're in as human beings, that we're conditioned to have this suffering arise instead of see the freedom that's available all the time. So taking refuge in the Buddha, we can of course take refuge in the historical figure of the Buddha, and many people find that strengthening to call to mind. And that's sort of the traditional taking refuge in the Buddha. But it's really can be expanded and broadened to taking refuge in our own capacity for awakening. And again, for me, what I often do is I call to mind how this practice has, in very specific ways, taken me through really difficult experiences, and I've come out seeing the way towards freedom rather than having been completely overtaken by those experiences. And so if there's anything, if you think about taking refuge in the Buddha and it as taking refuge in your own potential for awakening, you know, it might be helpful to think of what, you know, there must be something that's bringing you back to this practice or bringing you here. And you can see there's some seeing, there's some knowledge of the potential for awakening. And it's there in your mind, in your system. So kind of turning towards that as a refuge can be helpful. And it's really interesting because I've over time I've seen this more clearly, and I think in taking refuge in all of the triple gems, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, eventually it starts to be a practice in which the sense of separation and the sense of self as the center of everything can start to dissolve and slip away. And in this connection between kind of calling to mind the Buddha's awakening, the potential for awakening, our own potential for awakening, there's this slipping away and this kind of merger with the rest of humanity, really, in the sense that we're part of this larger group of human beings who have this potential for awakening. So Ajahn Chah, interestingly, describes the Buddha, taking refuge in the Buddha in a way that I think evokes this or calls this to mind. He says, "We take refuge in the Buddha, but what is the Buddha? When we see with the eye of wisdom, we know that the Buddha is timeless, unborn, unrelated to anybody, any body, any history, any place. Buddha is the ground of all being, the realization of the truth of the unmoving mind. So the Buddha was not enlightened in India. In fact, he was never enlightened. He was never born and never died. This timeless Buddha is our true home, our abiding place." So so it's really interesting because there's a sort of a paradoxical way in which we're taking refuge. We take refuge in the Buddha and then in our own capacity for awakening. And then there's a slipping away of our own part of it. There's a connection, a deep connection. So taking refuge in the Dharma. And the Dharma can be translated and thought of as in a couple of ways. The truth of the way things are, or the teachings. So we take refuge in the truth. I really resonate with the taking refuge in the truth of the way things are. Because it calls to mind that we're often not just turning towards the truth. And what we're taking refuge in is the fact that there, we can think about it as taking refuge in sort of knowing the three characteristics of existence, of conditioned existence, familiar probably from the teachings that you've heard, the truths of unsatisfactoriness of our conditioned existence, the truths of impermanence, and the truth of not self. And I like to think of this as, it's helpful for me turning towards the truth. So the truth is this conditioned existence is unsatisfactory. So knowing and reminding myself when I take refuge in the Dharma, the happiness is not going to come from acquiring more of these unsatisfactory material things, things that are unreliable, right? And just, again, turning to that seed of knowing that's there instead of, so turning away from what you may get caught up in daily life when you kind of forget that's not the way to happiness or freedom. Or there tends to be this belief that we fall into and that causes friction and suffering in the mind, which is, I want things to be different than the way they are, you know. And instead turning towards, okay, all of this conditioned existence is going to have this rub. It's going to have this friction. And as long as I'm in conflict with the way things are, as long as I'm trying to push that away, then there's suffering. So turning towards that truth, just kind of doing that little remembering, and it's sort of in a way a kind of a wisdom reflection for me, this taking refuge in the truth and taking refuge in the Dharma. you know, knowing, seeing how wisdom has arisen in the mind and how we can sort of just turn to it and know that, those seeds of wisdom. You know, and the taking refuge in the unsatisfactory, the knowledge, the wisdom, really. It's not taking refuge in the actual characteristics necessarily, but the wisdom, the knowing of them. So the knowing of impermanence. Similarly, the knowing that impermanent experiences are not going to be the source of our happiness or contentment, but instead living aligned with the knowledge of impermanence will be that. And not self. Actually, you know, it's often presented as, oh, this is so difficult, you know, this is a really difficult to understand, and it is. And we don't want to intellectualize it. But it can be so peaceful to kind of just realize and take in for a moment and taking refuge in the truth that happiness is not going to come from creating some kind of self. Like, we've seen ourselves try to create this over and over again. I'll create this self that's suddenly going to, it's going to have enough of the particular characteristics I think are great, that it's going to then provide me with happiness. And we've seen that. We can see that over and over. We've kind of done this in our life, and the ground has been taken out from underneath us. So we can turn towards that wisdom of, like, I don't have to keep creating the self. So we can take refuge in the truth. And in doing that, it's really, we're taking refuge in a safe path, in something that's safe, something that's more reliable than these impermanent and conditioned experiences. The Buddha really described the practice as a way of finding true safety, as a way of finding a path that's not false. He described the Dharma as a raft from a fearsome shore over to a shore where there's not fear, you know. So it's taking refuge in a true kind of safety, a more reliable kind of safety. So in taking, you know, in actually to oneself or out loud taking refuge in the Dharma, I feel like it's kind of a way in which can be reminded that everything that arises can be a vehicle for awakening. You know, whatever's arising right now that I feel that I need a refuge from, whatever's arising in the mind that's causing suffering, turning back to the Dharma towards it. So it can be like this recommitment and this intention. And taking refuge in the Sangha. This is such a rich and powerful refuge, I think, supportive refuge for us. Traditionally, it's taking refuge in the monastic Sangha, people who have really renounced and so put all of their energy towards awakening, renounced material things, renounced any property and, you know, or celibate. But also taking refuge in all the other awakened beings who have come in the past or currently, people who are realized in some way that we can turn towards as models or as guides. So, like I said, I was kind of inspired to talk on this topic by being able to practice with Ayasantachitta and Ayananda-bodhi. And feeling the refuge of that. So we need this sort of resonance with other practitioners and with other people who are practicing and seeing the truth in order to support our practice. And the Buddha talked about this really clearly, He placed great significance and importance on spiritual friendship and Sangha. And there are some really kind of beautiful aspects of the texts, I think, about this. One of them you may have heard, pretty famous, just paraphrasing. The Buddha had this very strong attendant, his close attendant, Ananda. And at one time, Ananda came to him and was sort of, he was saying the Dharma, and he was saying, oh, something to the effect of the Buddha. Spiritual friendship is half of the holy life. And the Buddha said to him, oh, no, don't say that, Ananda. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the holy life. It's the whole of the practice. There's also this beautiful story where the Buddha is with this sort of younger, newer practitioner. And I think it's just him. It may be the Buddha and this fellow and then another bhikkhu, but I can't remember. But they're wandering. And this sort of newer, sincere practitioner comes up to the Buddha and says, oh, I found this beautiful mango grove. I found this beautiful mango grove. It looks so great for practicing. I really want to go there. And he asked the Buddha, and oftentimes in the text, someone asks the Buddha something three times, and then the Buddha finally relents. The Buddha keeps saying, no, let's wait until the rest of the, you know, bhikkhus come. Let's wait until the rest of the sangha comes to go and practice in that mango grove. And then finally, on the third time, the Buddha relents. Okay, go and practice there. And so then he goes and practices there, and then he comes back to the Buddha, and he says something, again, paraphrasing, he says to the Buddha, I went and I practiced in this wonderful place, but all of these thoughts, my mind kept being invaded by thoughts of cruelty and lust, and I kept having all of these hindrances, basically. And the Buddha responded, that's why it's best to wait and to practice with, you know, the other practitioners, essentially, or the other bhikkhus. And so we need to have this reflection of the practice. Another really, really brief teaching, one of my favorite brief teachings from the suttas is this teaching. It's a teaching on wise view. So there are two, it says, there are two conditions for the arising of wise view. And wise view is returning back to, you know, the truth of the way things are. Wise view is about conditioned existence being unsatisfactory, impermanent, not self. There are two conditions for the arising of wise view: wise attention and the voice of another. So we need this, we need each other to sort of see the Dharma in action and to hear the Dharma. And so this is a relational aspect to the practice that I think sometimes often gets perhaps overlooked, particularly in our little culture here. I was recently talking about, we had a discussion about taking refuge in the Sangha in the people of color group that I co-lead. And one of the people in the group said, you know, I really appreciate the Sangha. I really like the Sangha because here I can come and say things that otherwise are taboo, right? And when we talk about the practice and we talk about actually living aligned with the truth of impermanence, knowing it, those kind of things, we're saying something that doesn't get said a lot out there. We're saying something that's contrary and against the stream, against the strain of dominant culture, which is actually, you know, telling us, and we get a lot of messages, that, okay, you're actually going to be happy if you got the right car, or you have the right job, or you have the right relationship, or you should, you know, this is what you should be, how you should be navigating life, and this is how you should be finding happiness or impermanence, is by grasping onto things that are actually not, we know, not so reliable, right? And so, with taking refuge in the Sangha, we're able to have that mirror and that reflection. And to really support each other in that way. When I take refuge in the Dharma, take refuge in the Sangha to myself, I do something, maybe it's a little unusual, but and maybe it's more fits into taking refuge in the Dharma, but this is, I actually call to mind what I say to myself that strengthens, that helps support my practice, and maybe it will have some resonance with you or light a spark of some kind. But I recall to mind something that's very supportive for me, which is that this is not my Dharma practice. I don't own it. It's not something separate from all of the conditions and all of the teachings and guidance and all of the everything that's come to this moment. There's nothing separate there. There's nothing that I can hold on to. And the gratitude I have towards all the conditions, all the beings that have contributed to me being able to find really a much, much greater ease and happiness with life through the practice, to knowing it. It's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary gift, really unusual, to be able to have this much access to the Dharma. Extraordinary. And this freedom to practice. So that's part of what I call to mind. But I also call to mind times in the practice where I've really known that it's unfolding in a way that's not, it's just unfolding, it's doing itself. When I'm sitting, practicing formally, and when I'm practicing informally also, it's not something I'm creating, but it's a resting into seeing the truth. Nothing is being created by a self, by me. And so in this taking refuge in the Sangha, it's a real kind of a slipping into, again, that letting the self drop away. So it's interesting, this paradox, and I see it for through all the three gems, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, that they're sort of, that they're kind of radically connecting. And the paradox is, again, you know, we start off taking refuge in the Dharma. It's like, oh, there's the self, and I'm going for refuge, you know, to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And when we just, and it can be very brief, when we inquire into what those things are, they're pointing us towards not some kind of separate self going for refuge, but a larger connection to the whole stream of what it means to be a human being, and to what it means to start to see how suffering is caused, and to start to see the mechanism of it, and to start to see the way out, and that it's not something that involves some kind of separate being creating something. So taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha also can really just be a simple way to bring up confidence in the practice. You know, we just reminding ourselves why we keep coming back. You know, setting an intention. Because if you've come here, if you're practicing, you do have, you know, there is that seed. You know, the Buddha said someone was exhorting him to teach. Someone was exhorting him to teach. And he was thinking, well, I might not teach. Someone said to him, well, there are those with but little dust in their eyes. You know, so it's remembering that, so we can turn back and take refuge just to have that confidence in the practice that we know that this is the path rather than something else. And this is so important because in many ways doubt, the opposite of confidence in the practice, which may be sitting back there. I find it sitting back there in the mind, sneakily, like that trickster that Mara was talking about. I find it sitting back in the mind, kind of subtly trying to undermine my practice and subtly trying to undermine the sense of ease and contentment I can have by kind of niggling in there. It's like there can be these little thoughts of, I'm not really worth it. You know, I can't really do this practice. Or maybe for everybody else, but not me. And that's the little self-doubt. And sometimes it can be much stronger. It can be like a self-criticism or a self-judgment. Sometimes I find it back there. There's really no difference, ultimately, between doubt in the practice as the as the path, and doubt in the self. Because the teaching, the truth is that it's accessible to all of us. There is no truth whatsoever to the idea that there's someone here who's better capable and someone who's not. That's just a false view, wrong view. So it's often this there's this little doubt that can be hovering back there. And I think taking refuge, perhaps before practicing or doing it as a practice, can help to counter that, to give us confidence in the practice. Even if we just see that little doubt, that takes us a little bit further. It's like, oh, this is the way, and I have this capacity for awakening, just as everyone else does. So I really like this, in the text, there are all these practitioners who are kind of struggling in some way, or they come into the Buddha and they ask him, and then there's some of them are completely doubtful first. You know, they're like, oh, they're practicing in some other tradition, and they're like, I'm going to show up the Buddha, I'm going to go, and I'm going to show how he doesn't know what he's talking about. And some of them are just kind of more sincerely asking. In the end, often they come and they express how they've been convinced by the Buddha by taking refuge. And I just really like the way this is. One practitioner says this, after hearing the discourse of the Buddha and seeing, oh yeah, this is he really knows what he's talking about. This particular practitioner said it this way. The Buddha has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. You know? So when we take refuge, we can take refuge in just that, in that knowing the truth and turning away from greed, hatred, and delusion, strain that's otherwise often operating in the mind or in the world. So those are my thoughts today about taking refuge. And so I just want to turn it out, turn the everything open. I like to have plenty of time for discussion or questions about practice or anything else that you all might want to talk about. Great to hear people's voice in the room and hear about people's practice. Not just have it be a back of the head sangha. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Sylvie.
Sylvie, hi.
Hi. You mentioned in one story, dust in the eye. And then you kind of closed over it quickly.
Okay.
Could you explain what it really meant?
Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's part of a sutta, so one can interpret it differently. They're open for our interpretation, and also they're all translations and so on. But the particular part of that sutta I was referring to was relatively soon after the Buddha was awakened, according to the sutta, he was expressing doubts about whether he should teach. And he was saying, oh, it's hard to understand. The Dhamma is difficult to understand. He was according to the sutta, he was encountered by, I'm thinking it's a Brahma, if I'm remembering correctly, so some kind of celestial being. The Brahma was exhorting him to teach, and trying to convince him to do so. And he said, there are those with but little dust in their eyes who can see, who can hear the Dhamma and understand the Dhamma and become awake. So what I was kind of pointing to is that I think that line is actually just moving in a way. that there are many of us around who have but little dust in our eyes, so the delusion is not so thick, right? The delusion is not so thick, and we can see that our typical ways of trying to escape suffering are actually often causing us more suffering. And that if we relate to our experience in a different way, that might be the way to freedom and happiness. And so there are those for whom the delusion is perhaps not quite so thick. And you know, we don't want to go along on some kind of measuring way. You know, I also said in this talk, it's like there's no one here to whom awakening is not accessible, and that's also true. But I just think that image of the delusion kind of just being a little bit of dust in the eyes, to me it's quite moving, and to think of the people that we're practicing with as fellow people who just have a little dust and maybe a little less delusion, so we can, let's relate, let's get together, let's practice, let's support each other. So that's kind of what I was referring to. Did that explain it a little better?
Yeah, I really love it. I think it's very poetic, so that's why I wanted to ask more about it. Like the way my mind interpreted it, not knowing the story in the back, was that the dust in the eye is kind of the delusion. Mm-hmm. And so that, like, kind of, you know, I just saw like every being is kind of is born with dust in the eye, and you know, we take it off slowly.
yeah. And I think sometimes through our lifetime we get more layers of dust after being born, yeah. And so then we have to. But yeah, it's just kind of a beautiful image and a way of thinking about delusion or our not seeing the truth all the time as something that we can actually work with. It's dust in the eyes, right?
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for being here. My name's Jeannie. Mm-hmm. And I really liked what you said about the definition kind of Buddha, mm-hmm. Being knowledge and understanding. And I've always thought that so the truth being the knowledge or understanding of the oneness of all beings.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel a deep sadness because I, you know, see how this is causing strife in the world. That we don't get this, we don't see it. And so then I thought, well, you had mentioned, you know, like before you, to practice gratitude, mm-hmm. for, you know, the positives. And maybe this would help me to relieve that sadness.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, gratitude is a wonderful practice, and practicing gratitude can really just be great as a part of wise effort, bringing wholesome intent, like wholesome mind states into the mind stream to kind of, because if there's a sense of, I mean, sadness can actually be, when we feel it in the moment, maybe not so harming, in the sense of maybe it's not really so harming. It can just be something that kind of passes through the mind stream. So, of course, you can practice with it with mindfulness and turn the attention towards that and see how does that really feel in the body and in the mind with the sadness. But also any of the, you know, whenever there's kind of a prevalence of a strongly aversive or harming state of mind in the mind, to practice wise effort to cultivate instead non-harming and wholesome attitudes of mind can just be helpful. And so the gratitude practice is a part of that. Also, loving kindness practice and metta practice. So is that, are you doing the gratitude practice, and is that helping?
I do metta quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it does help. And maybe I'm not, it's not an aversive kind of thing, that I'm feeling the sadness, and maybe I'm thinking that it's perhaps a negative when it is just an is.
Well, you can know, because in the sense, it's for you to explore, is this particular mind state that you're experiencing, noticing it in the body and the mind, is it harming? Is it, instead of being just a kind of a pure sadness that's passing through, because we can just feel loss, okay, it's just passing through, and then it's going away, or we can identify with it as like, okay, it's my sadness, and there's sort of a longing that keeps going on, and you can know the difference. Yeah, you can kind of know the difference yourself. So yeah, exploring that yourself.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to thank you for your teaching. Mm-hmm. And if it's not too personal, I wonder if you could comment on what it is in your life that brought you to the Dharma.
Oh, wow. Okay. I often kind of think of how can I have a good, clear, answer to this question? So I just, there was a lot of dukkha. There was just a lot of dukkha in the mind. And I mean a lot. I would probably say the most dukkha there was, maybe I would say it was anxiety. I just started doing mindfulness. I read a little bit about mindfulness and also about loving kindness. And I just started, I thought, I was basically at my wit's end. I was like, I'll try anything, but I'll try this. But I also actually had a significant amount of, I was really aware that I was not aware a lot in life. There was a lot of in the psychological term you would call disassociation, but there was some pretty, unawareness. And so I was very intrigued by this teaching of mindfulness, that awareness could actually lead to happiness. And I felt that I wanted to be more aware of what was going on, just what was happening. And so I tried it. And really, I think for many people who are experiencing a lot of dukkha, sometimes the relief that comes immediately from mindfulness and or loving kindness is so, it seems small in that moment, but it really feels huge, right? Because there's this relief, right? There's this there's this space that one didn't realize was possible. It's like, okay, I'd been running away from these feelings that were so difficult for so long. Like what did it actually mean? When I actually turned to pay attention with some caring, because the loving kindness was a part of the practice, to the anxiety, it was like, oh, I can actually meet this experience. And so I did that. And I mean, it was just really a matter I had this experience. But I also think it's really interesting. We have to come to this point where we're open to the Dharma. Because I was realizing the other day, I had this whole other period in my life when I was around 19 or 20. I was in college, and I studied Buddhism. I happened to have the good fortune. I was to go to some of the pilgrimage sites, like Bodh Gaya, when I was in college. But I was completely closed off to the Dharma. I was like, this sounds awful. I mean, really, it's pretty fascinating. Ultimately, for me, it was the experiential, it was the experience. It was the being open to, okay, there's another, there. Maybe if I relate to my experience by turning towards it and I actually try this awareness thing, like what would it be like to be more aware? And also opening to the loving kindness. But I essentially, I had a lot of anxiety from like my childhood experiences, and also, I was a lawyer, I still am, and that's an anxiety profession. So, yeah, it was dukkha. We all come, a lot of people come through this dukkha route, right? And it can come in so many different forms.
Just have a question about what you stated earlier, and if you can just expand on it, re-expand on it for me. You said that there were two conditions for wise view, wise attention. What did you mean by that specifically? Was it sort of the meditation practice itself? And then the voice of another, I assume you meant Sangha.
So it's a little, you know, that's the part, you know, it's kind of sitting there, and there's not a lot of explanation. So it's my interpretation of it. Okay, so wise view is understanding, wise view is not taking things that are impermanent to be permanent, not taking things that are unsatisfactory to be satisfactory, not taking things that are not self to be self. So that's wise view in a nutshell. Okay, so there are two conditions for the arising of it. Wise attention and the voice of another. So if I just read wise intention or thought of wise intention, I might think, you know, this is just referring to mindfulness. And maybe it's just mindfulness and the voice of another. So someone who is pointing the way towards wise view, someone who's talking about wise view. It's really interesting part of the teachings because it doesn't necessarily match up with a whole lot of others. There's this list of two conditions for the arising of wise view. And what is so beautiful about that for me is that it's saying you really have to hear the Dhamma from someone else. Now, there may be very, very few people on this earth who are like the Buddha, very, very few beings who arise who don't need to hear it from someone else and can go practice under a tree and they'll see it for themselves. But even the Buddha had teachers before. He had teachers who taught him the jhanas. So he had teachers who pointed him in various different directions, and ultimately he had to sit down and see it all for himself. He sat down in the scientific way, he studied what causes suffering, what doesn't cause suffering, and then he saw. But literally, I mean, I think it means mindful, wise attention to what someone else is saying that is wise view and pointing towards wise view. So we really need to come back and hear the have you noticed how you need to come back and hear them over and over again? Because of this dust in our eyes that kind of, it's like, you have to keep wiping it away. But it's really interesting part of the teachings, you know. There's teachings that say that we have to do this practice kind of repetitively. We hear it from a teacher, and then we practice it, and then we come back and we do it again and again. The Dhamma, the truth of the way things are, we have that dust in our eyes, so it's not clear to us. We need to have the voice of another, and doesn't have to be a teacher. Sometimes a non-practitioner has this, you know, has plenty of wisdom, you know, maybe garnered from past lives or whatever, is wise and compassionate, and they'll be the voice of another. And if you pay attention, oh, it's like, oh, I can, now I'll be, okay, I'm out of my delusion now, right? Bringing that part of the teaching in, that Sangha and spiritual friendship is so important for the practice. Okay, thank you everyone so much for your participation and your attention. It's wonderful to be here. Let's just share the merit briefly. Any benefit that arises from our practice today be shared with all beings. May it serve to awaken all beings. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free of suffering. May all beings be protected from inner and outer harm. May all beings be awake.